Could you just introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. Justin Chang, hello. Film critic for The New Yorker. I'm 42, if we're telling ages. So that's, you know. And yeah, happy to be here. Yes.
Awesome, thanks. Are there any sort of topics that you want us to touch on in particular? Just because I know you've had previous interviews and we don't kind of want to, you know, step on any toes or anything or have you repeat things. Like.
I'm really quite open to anything, really, and I came in not really necessarily knowing what you know what your questions would be, but anything's fine. I may repeat things that I've possibly said before, but I mean, think about talking with my students. I really do. It's interesting. One of the reasons I like teaching, it's challenging, it's rewarding too, is I do like talking about writing and the writing process. And so, if that interests you all, I'd be happy to you know talk about just what I talk to them about because it's. It's hard to talk about writing sometimes and how you do it. And that's partly why I like doing it, you know, because it sometimes helps me make sense of why do I do things this way? You can't really you know, writing is a very personal thing for everyone, I think, who does it in any way. And so, so that's, you know, that's something I enjoy talking about, but please don't limit yourself to, you know, anything is fine. Yeah.
Awesome, thanks. So my name's Pia, I'm 23. I am a filmmaker, critic, like half and half, I'm best of both worlds kind of thing. I just wanted to ask, like, you're very active sort of like in online spaces, like on the website formerly known as Twitter, and like Reddit and things. What can you tell us about like the differences in discourse between offline and online conversations about film? Like, do you find offline more or less harsh in terms of criticism, or is it the other way around?
Yeah. I should say too that I've pulled back like a lot of people from social media for somewhat obvious reasons. It's just totally toxic. And Blue Sky's nicer these days. You know, I'm finding it's lovely. But even then, I'm not as active. I'm always. And there was a time though around that like 2017, 2018 era where I was active and I just liked telling jokes. So it was just fun to you know get those there. Just it was an outlet for. You know, I wasn't really. I don't actually. Like to really broadcast my opinions on social media. I've made exceptions to that, of course, but it's usually, even when I've made those exceptions, it's usually hopefully backed up by, here's a piece I've written. This piece will say things better than I could possibly say here, than I could spout off here on Twitter or the site formerly known as Twitter. So I guess the answer is I much prefer the offline conversations. When I have reader engagement, I much prefer to just write emails to readers, and it's usually, even if they are taking me to task, somebody who's bothered writing an email is usually reasonably polite and friendly, and those are some of the best letters to get sometimes, and I don't respond to everyone, but I try. And, but yeah, the online conversation, yeah, no, there are people who are really good at it, and people who are, I'm not on Letterboxd, you know, people who are, including some great critics, a friend of mine like David Ehrlich for IndieWire, of course, is like king of Letterboxd, navigating that would be a completely overwhelming and weird experience for me. But I think it's great. I mean, I do feel fortunate in that I'm not required to do too much social media, in that I've worked for places that do believe in just your work first and foremost, and who, you know, and they want you to promote things and they promote your work, which is great. But you don't have to have this whole other identity, which I'm grateful for. I can just kind of dip in and out as I see fit. I do things like, you know, The New Yorker does TikTok videos, which are fun to do. And it's really funny when they first told me, it's like, oh, dang, I'm not sure I'm this cut out for this. I'm not a TikToker. But I did take consolation fact, but this is The New Yorker. They will be the classiest, most rigorously fact-checked TikToks that ever existed. So I feel like I'm in good hands. And it's been fun. I try not to read the comments, though, because that was eye-opening. And not always in a good way.
And, like, I just wanted to ask as well, like, you know, what's your sort of opinion on Letterboxd as a platform? Like, I feel like a lot of people view it as kind of bridging the gap between, like, the public and the critics.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because I think that, and I have no real negative thoughts beyond my just not being part of it is not a rejection of it at all. I find myself reading a lot of things. I don't, beyond my friends and colleagues who I know there, I don't really latch on to individual personalities or people so much, but I know that I've read, wow, this is a really insightful piece, you know? And this is better than some published, you know, some professionally published pieces, and it's like, this should be published somewhere. But then also at the same time, of course, you do get the sort of the one sentence or two sentence reviews that are just screen grabbed on Twitter, and that are just, you know, it's used as like, you know, like to dunk on movies or to dunk on the person who wrote it. It's just, you know, and that's, yeah, it's fun to read, whatever, but it's like, that's, but at the same time, who knows? I mean, great critics will emerge from Letterboxd. I'm convinced, of course. You know, people who really will, anything that gets you to practice your craft as a writer, whether that's, and I'm, you know, I've come up through just writing for legacy publications my whole life, and, you know, I've been fortunate to do that, but at the same time, it's like, there's maybe something stifling about that, too. It's, so I'm all for, you know, they will, you know, absolutely great writers will come from, great writers and thinkers on movies will come from anywhere, and that includes Letterboxd very much, so.
My name is Chloe. I am 20 years old. I'm a film student, young film critic, filmmaker, content creator. I really love academia, so this is really fun. I want to start with a really kind of simple question.
Sure.
How did you find your critic voice? Because you've been doing this for a while, and it's very much something that influences the trajectory of your career.
It's really interesting because I think a critical voice has maybe more than one component, of course. There's the voice of just like what your written voice is, what your prose style is. And then there's the part of your voice, I think, that is like what matters to you and what are you passionate about? And of course, those things all work together. But I would say, and I know this might seem a strange answer, but I sometimes feel like I'm still finding it. It's weird. I really do mean that. Like, and in a way that's partly because I've written for different publications, and that does change your voice a little bit. I mean, I like to think that, you know, it's nice to think, and it's good to think that, you know, the places that have been good enough to hire me because they want me, because they like my voice, but I've always thought of this as a very malleable thing, and I've written for a trade publication where, for a while, when I was working there, the idea of writing for Variety was to sort of subjugate your voice, or kind of like, you know, it was more the voice of the publication that from which authority derived. And so, to not be too personal, to not be too opinionated even. Now, the great thing about that was, and the great joy of writing there, was finding ways to be personal and to write, hopefully well, beautifully, memorably even, within a strict format that was very geared toward the industry. That was, so I felt like I had the most restrictions writing there, but in a way, restrictions can really liberate you, right? And so finding my voice in that way. There are times, even though, like, you know, I'm here, and I work at The New Yorker now, and I've loved writing at all three of these papers, and in some ways I look back, and I'm still most proud of certain things I wrote for Variety, because they were harder. And because it was harder to find whatever my voice was, you know, there. And then at the LA Times, I had more freedom. I was speaking not to industry, but more to just, you know, general moviegoers for the most part. And now at The New Yorker, it's a whole other thing. And where you're there, it's like the standard of writing is, of course, so high that you're, and it's like I did feel early on like I was figuring out how to write all over again. But, and my voice changes sometimes, I feel, from piece to piece. And I don't love this about myself. There's sometimes I read critics I admire, and I think, wow, I feel like I see their voice, I hear it very clearly in every piece. And for me, I always say that I learned how to do this. It was a good thing to say, but kind of through mimicry. I, like, channel the people that I like to read. That's how, I'm very self-taught, you know? And sometimes I'll even say, like, depending on the movie, I'll think, like, oh, this is kind of a this critic kind of movie. I don't even love sharing this, but like it's funny because it feels almost like weirdly like parasitic or inauthentic or something. But I like to think that in that process of just channeling, of course my voice comes through. And so, and I don't know what my voice is to people. I've heard people who've told me, close friends, colleagues, say that there is, you know, that they feel like after a certain point, having read me for some time or even for several years, they feel like they do feel they can trust me, which is nice to hear, and that there's something, you know, and that I'm a good guide, you know, to them, and so that which really means a lot. yeah, voice is a funny thing, you know, and it's weird. It's like, you know, people think of voice as being something like authoritative, which still is kind of funny to me. I don't think about authority that much. I often try to approach the movie with a little humility, which I think maybe leads to authority. I don't know. But I think, yeah, and part of that humility is saying I am still finding it. It changes. It changes depending on the movie, and every assignment is different, and it keeps it interesting. So, yeah.
Hi, my name is Siveta Afui, and yeah, I'm 24, and yeah, kind of similar to Pia, criticism, but filmmaking slightly as well. And yeah, my question is about you being in an industry for so long now, and obviously, I think it was Mark Twain who said that if you work something that you love, you don't work at all, really. However, I do not agree with that. I think that especially if you're professionally doing something that you're passionate about, previously, it can become kind of the line gets blurry, and it can become very mundane in a way, or there is a certain fatigue that might prevail. So my question is, how do you keep your passion for cinema alive, in a sense, or for films? How do you keep enjoying them despite having to be always critical of them? And do you actually, can you turn off your critical thinking if you're watching something just purely to unwind?
Yeah. Those are all really great intertwined questions, and I think about this constantly. And it's funny because I maybe half agree with the Mark Twain quote, because there is absolutely something where you feel like, and that's true for all of you, I hope it is, where you're doing some of the work you're doing and you're like, wow, I would do this for free, you know, thankfully, hopefully not, hopefully, okay, you know, be remunerated well for, you know, as we all should be, but like, I did have that mind when I was first starting out, and it drove me, and it, I think it showed my future employers that like, wow, this kid's serious, and we'll, you know, really, you know, and his work is good, we'll give him more to do, and that's a really good, you know, position to be in, I think, when you're starting out, especially, is to feel like, yeah, and there is no division between doing this for pleasure or doing it for work, but yes, it's different now, and I'll just tell you, too, because I also do programming for the New York Film Festival, and you know, a very light, I don't do nearly as much as, like, really full-time hardcore programmers do. It's like, I think of it as like dipping a little toe into the programming world. But even that, it's like, it's watching more movies than I usually do, and it's watching screeners, and kind of just cycling through a lot in a way, and so you're not really watching with a critic's eye, because you're not writing about most of the movies, and you're just trying to see, is this good? Is this something we want to show our audiences in New York? And it's a different exercise, and it does contribute to, yes, this kind of fatigue sometimes where you're just like, I cannot watch another movie. My eyeballs are going to pop out of my head, and you just need to do something else. I do think it's very healthy to just go and do something else. Speaking about recharging, it's like, yeah. It's the same with writing, too. There are times when I'm like, I'm so sick of writing. I am so sick of my voice. I hate my voice. I don't want to be around my voice. And then I go, and I like, you know, just don't do something else for a few days, maybe, and, you know, spend time with my family. What a concept, you know, it's like, which is important, which is another thing, you know, work-life balance, all of that. I'm, you know, my kids are, I have two kids who are young, and so it's like, that's another factor too. So, but then I'll start reading again. I'm like, wow, this is great. And then you get excited to write again, you get excited to see movies again. And for me now, I will say, because I don't write as many pieces for The New Yorker, I mean, I don't cover as many movies, that my pace has definitely changed as a writer, and it's a much more selective publication in terms of what they cover, so I have a lot more freedom, and because of that, there is the risk of getting lazy and actually not seeing, like, I feel really like there are a lot of movies that I have not seen, and I feel like where, like, 15 years ago I was doing more of my due diligence and watching everything or close to everything, it's like now it's much more. So it's a weird thing because, like, I have the programming thing on the one hand where I'm watching a lot of stuff, but then I feel like I'm not going to, like, the movies as much. I'm not going to, like, my multiplex as much. I'm skipping out on a lot of Hollywood stuff, which is maybe not the worst thing, but even so, you do want to keep your hand in there. So I don't know. It's just a balance. You just find, you know, you work as hard as you can, and then you rest as hard as you can. It's kind of funny, I tell this in terms of like the whole turning your brain off division of, you know, work versus pleasure. I mean, sometimes after we put the kids to sleep, my wife and I will be like, let's watch a movie, you know, sure, or more likely let's watch a TV show, you know, it's like, but watch a movie, and my wife will ask me, okay, do you want, is this for, are we watching for fun or for work? It's like, because she knows I have this backlog of things that I need to see, and so it's like, and sometimes I'll try to be like, no, let's not do a work thing, let's just watch something for fun, you know, and so, but that's a question we're constantly asking in our house. And yeah, it's funny. Turn your brain. I don't. It's that whole question. I think you as critics will get this question a lot yourselves of like turning your brain off. And it's like, you know, you do relax when you don't have to write about something. But you do this long enough and it becomes harder to turn your brain off than easier. And you'd really rather not. And so you might not. I don't bring a notebook to every movie I see. But I have seen things where like, I'm not necessarily planning to write about something, but something will, I'm like, huh, this is, there's something going on here that kind of resonates with something else I saw, and oh, there's a piece here, you know, that kind of thing. And so your mind just will start naturally making those connections kind of effortlessly without your telling it to. But like, you know, you do this long enough, it's like, you know, your brain doesn't stop working. Your taste doesn't go away. Your taste is changing. It's like, it's not like suddenly you regress to like having worse taste, so, which is a good thing, you know? So, it's, yeah, there is that thing though. Sometimes I do feel like, yeah, it's the kind of thing where like if you're a chef and like your taste buds weaken over time. And sometimes I'm cognizant of that as a moviegoer, you know, your taste buds as a moviegoer sometimes weaken over time too. And it's like, and so you experience things differently from say, someone who only sees like 5 movies a year, right? If that. And I don't know how to get around that. It's just the critic's lot. You just kind of have to deal with that and be conscious of it and understand that the right readers you're writing for may come at things differently. And so you have to kind of take their inexperience into account a little bit, maybe. So at the same time, I always still think at the end of the day, no, this has to make sense for me. This has to be what I think and no one else, you know. So it's a balance of like, yeah, of those two things. I know that's kind of a contradiction, but yeah.
Hi, I'm Sasha. I'm 18. And I was wondering, obviously you teach students and recently there's been an uprise on through social media of a lot of young people similar to my age, maybe even a bit younger, that it's kind of, they're kind of getting a lot of media literacy. And I was wondering if that affects your career as a film critic or has had an impact on your teaching.
Right. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more in terms of like, I guess, like people like, I think I know a little what you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, media literacy, a thing of like where something will be out on social media and it's like people coming to drastically different conclusions on it based on, you know, and then there's the really dumb interpretation versus the smarter one. Is that kind of, is that sort of what you're talking about? Yeah,
kind of like that, because I noticed with, not to go back to the movie, but with Nosferatu, there was a lot of very devised takes through that.
Right.
And there was some takes that were very much like, did we watch the same movie? Like, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that kind of thing happens, and I think that in some ways it's like the Netflixication of everything, where clips can be sort of pulled out and put online. Like, I remember, it's kind of a different thing, but like, what you were telling me reminded me of like when the big marital spat scene in Marriage Story, obviously just gets, you know, and this was like the first, like within days or maybe hours even of Marriage Story popping up, and like just the most like divisive or difficult or just the most attention-grabbing things are pulled out of the movie, and this is why filmmakers are not well served by going to Netflix. It's not. They don't care about your movies, and it's not, you know, this is why theaters are important. Blah blah blah. You know about my spiel, but it's like they will just kind of respond, and it's like you're just divorcing the scene completely from its context, of course, and which is not a good thing. And yeah, it does sort of. I mean, I don't even know if it's media literacy. It's just like media incomplete. You don't know what this is, you know, you're trying to conclude things like based on how can you judge if this is like a badly acted scene based on, you know, it's like you don't know, you're just like, and so it becomes this way, I think, of being very dismissive of things. And it's not like the movies should be, you know, praised by default, but you got to give it a chance by at least like giving it the time to really make its own case for itself. And so I do think that a lot of that is just ends up just devaluing the art, really. I will say one of the reasons I love teaching, and it's a lot of work. It's extra, but I really enjoy doing it. I don't think I can give it up, and I've been doing it for about, this is I think my fourth, it's my fifth year doing it. I do like knowing what young people are, like a group from which I now exempt myself, are interested in, and it's heartening to know that the folks who find their way into my class, and it's usually about 14 or 15 students every semester, really love movies, and they actually go to theaters as a matter of course. They're not doing it just for class. It's like they actually keep up with stuff, and that actually heartens me. And I know that the students, journalism students mostly, but some cinema students as well, who would sign up for my class are probably self-selecting, and so of course they're hardly representative of maybe the larger student body. But it does hearten me to know that, like, oh yeah, they actually signed up because they want an excuse to go to the movies for academic reasons, and it's like, you know, which is why I also took film classes in college, and it's like, they love them, and that gives me some hope, even if it's not everybody, it's some people, and it's helpful, and students are they're so smart and perceptive, and they catch things I don't get, they know things that I don't, it's just, you know. It's so important, I think. It's helpful for me to, like, it gives me new insight into things. And so, and it does give me hope for the medium as well, which really needs it, because, God, this business has always been hard, and it just gets harder every day. So,
I found the editing book you wrote, like, when I was researching all of this. I couldn't actually get it, because I was way too late. But, oh my God, I just wrote an editing essay, and I would have appreciated having that so much when I was writing it. You have no idea.
Thank you. It's funny because thank you for seeking out the book in any way, because it's out of print now. Yeah. And that was, it's a great book series that I was very happy to be a part of. And it's like, you know, it's the first and still only book I've ever done. It's, you know, a small effort, but it's, yeah, no, it was great getting to talk to all those editors, and I learned so much, and I've never done any filmmaking myself, but I always felt that if I did, I'd, you know, editing is what I'd want to do, and, you know, it's sort of, there's obviously, this is a bit reductive, but there are some similarities between film editing and editing as a writer, you know, just in terms of, you know, I found, anyways, it felt analogous to me. So, but yeah, no, that's great. So, do you do any editing, or are you just interested in it, or?
Yeah. Well, as part of my course, I'm in the middle of an editing module. I am way too perfectionistic for film editing, or for just editing in general. But I am a content creator, so I do edit all of that myself.
Yeah. Very cool. I actually did do some recent editing for the first time, really, where I had to put together a montage for our LA Film Critics Association dinner, which is our 50th anniversary, and so I decided, let's do a montage of, like, an Oscar-style thing, you know, like, all our Best Picture winners, so that was very fun, and I had got to play around with, you know, DaVinci Resolve for the very first time in my life. It's fun, you know.
I've happened to have the chance to be with a student accreditation at the Cannes Film Festival. Yes. And I have a very specific question about like film critics there, because it was very hectic. It's very overwhelming. So my question is, how much time, because there are screenings at like 11:30 and then at 7 a.m. in the morning, or like 8 a.m. So especially if you're not a freelancer, but representing a magazine, how much time do you have to put your thoughts on paper, or to how much you're given time from the editors? Can you revisit the articles later on, and just how that process of representing a magazine or a paper at a film festival goes
I have so much to say about that, because it's like covering the Cannes Film Festival for the first time at whatever point in your life or your career you are is one of the most fun and one of the most just horrible just overwhelming experiences a person could have, and it's interesting, because I'll tell you, and I'll break this down a little bit. I've covered Cannes for three different publications over the past, you know, close to 20 years now. I first went at Variety, where I was a full-time editor and writer for Variety, but I basically worked like in a way a lot of freelancers do, which is just you go and maybe, I don't know if this is your experience, but like just cranking out reviews and like trying to make sense of it. It was insane. And but for, you know, and I had a good badge because I was with Variety. It's like obviously the can is incredibly classist, and so the, you know, with their hierarchical system of badges and accreditation, so I'm sure you had to navigate some of that. Yeah. Everyone does. And yeah, it's interesting because I teach a film criticism class at USC, University of Southern California, which is my alma mater as well. And every year, about one or two of my students manages to get go cover Cannes. There's like a Cannes Classics program that the school kind of puts on, and I always tell them, it's great, it's going to be amazing, you know, it's the best experience you could possibly have, and it's going to change your life. You know, you'll never... I mean, it'll be really hard, but you'll want to come back too. I will say, so Variety was very much like intense that you go to the competition film screening in the morning, say, and because you're on deadline, you have to turn it around within hours. And when I was at Variety, we did, the trades still do these show dailies, print editions, or they're online versions to e-show dailies, but the print ones, which are produced in Cannes, you know, every day you see them, you pick up Screen International, Hollywood Reporter, all of that, right? And so you really have to turn around your review within like three, four hours. It was just insane. I'm so glad I don't have to do that anymore. At the same time, when you're there, your adrenaline just kicks in and you don't, who needs sleep? And something takes over you and you're good for about 5 or 6 days and then you start feeling sick and you're like, okay, by then the festival hopefully started to die down. When I was at the LA Times for 8 years, that was nice and it was much, some job got a lot easier because I didn't, you know, the LA Times, of course, doesn't review things like in full out of the festival unless it's something really big. But it's more, and so I got to take my time a little bit more. I don't have to write every day. I'm doing usually roundups of movies that, you know, I can kind of cogitate a little bit and think about what is really worth covering. Maybe even have time to do like an interview with somebody. You know, that's nice. And so it was a much more sane pace. And now at the New Yorker, my gosh, it feels like luxurious. It's kind of like, you know, this was my first year at Cannes for the New Yorker because I only joined the New Yorker in February 2024, and they did want, like, Megalopolis was there, and they actually did want a fast turnaround review of Megalopolis, which was like, okay, so I did that, and that actually was a pretty, more like a throwback to kind of the crazy early days. And then I did a big like 3,000-word essay on Furiosa and the Mad Max movies. So they're still interested in like the big stuff, the stuff that people and American readers, of course, will talk about. When I go to Cannes, of course, and any festival, I'm interested in the whole spectrum of world cinema. And so I like to just really see what's there. I was just at Berlin. I came here to Dublin from Berlin, so kind of soaked up what was there too. So I like to, you know, just to find things that are off the beaten path, of course, and that takes time. And so in general, I have a lot more time now to kind of do that, and to, you know, and New Yorker readers are, they care about movies, but it's, you know, they're not necessarily following the industry as much as, and it's interesting because I have, you know, starting at Variety as a kind of an industry paper, that's my background, and so that kind of seeps into my writing, even, you know, you can take the person out of the public, but you know, so but it's a balance and it's fun. It's been really rewarding to try to figure out festivals, movies in general, for different readers, different audiences, but always with the idea of, you know, cinema's really great and really important and there's something for you to find and discover. You know, that's what I try to keep in mind no matter what. So
thank you for that.
Sorry,
very thorough. No,
yes.
No, that
I'm
was
very
amazing.
Long-winded, as you can tell. So
in
I will try.
In terms
please
of what
tell,
you yeah. said just yeah. There, I remember listening to two critics at a very early screening in Cannes, and they were like, we don't ask ourselves if we like the film or not. We ask if we slept throughout the film or not in the morning. But yeah, it reminded me of that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that is, I will really quickly say to that, people have, you know, especially coming to Cannes from Los Angeles, where I live, I mean, I sometimes, the jet lag, just, you get over the jet lag just as the festival's ending, and so, and you know, there are stories about, like, there are stories of jurors who fall asleep during the movie that ends up winning the Palme d'Or. I know I'm not naming names, but there are stories, and it surely happens, you know. It reminds me of one of my favorite filmmakers, Apicha Pong Wirasethakul, who's the Thai filmmaker who's won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, actually. And his movies are, you know, very slow, very meditative, very soporific, as he openly says. And he says this thing where it's like, people tell him, your movies put me to sleep. And he will say, that's great, that's amazing. And it's true. Sometimes with a movie that's really slowing your rhythms, you... falling asleep during a movie can be a wonderful thing. And in a weird way, you enter into this kind of more of a dream state. And it's like, and I know that Peter Pong always wants to like know, like, when did you fall asleep? Tell me when. Like, that's interesting to him. Like, and when did you wake up? Like, what? Like, that's, you know, it's just a different way of connecting with the experience. So.
You mentioned that you were in Berlin recently.
Yeah.
For the festival, what was the movie you enjoyed the most for that? I know it's a basic question, but still.
Yes. I enjoyed a lot of things I saw, and I wasn't there for too long, but I saw about like 5 movies one day, which was kind of insane. Try not to do that too much. It's usually 3 or 2 a day, but one day I did 5. So I think I saw about 10 movies total. Not all of which I can remember right at this point in time. I really liked the new Hong Sang-soo movie, whose title is actually escaping me. Something about, oh my god, his titles can be a little cryptic, but this one is like something that, which is Your Nature. I'm going to get it so wrong. It's terrible. Anyways, really great Korean director, Hong Sang-soo, very prolific, often in Berlin. I really enjoyed that film, whatever it's called. And so it's funny, too, because I believe that the Berlin Awards are tonight, I'm very curious to see what they've chosen. There was another movie that I really liked called Dreams. It is by this Norwegian filmmaker, Dag Johan Haugerud, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's the third film in a trilogy that started, and the movies are called Sex, Love, and this one is Dreams. So those are first two films premiered at last year's festival. I didn't see them. I'm very curious to go back to them now because this new one, Dreams, is really quite good. I walked in not knowing a thing about it except that it was part of a trilogy, but a trilogy in which you can watch everything independently of the others. So that was a real find for me, and I'm curious to see. So it's called Dreams. It's a really lovely, funny, melancholy movie about youthful infatuation and first crush kind of thing that sort of, you know, transgresses some, but maybe not all boundaries. It's an interesting film. So, yeah.
Do you find that the kind of more melancholy or like the more darker tone films are sometimes better? Because the New York Review Hour podcast, it was like your downer films for the holidays.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It was a really interesting one, and The Brutalist is such a good film. I definitely agree. But that's, I think, funny. That'd be really fun to talk about.
It was funny, wasn't it? I think I chose like The Brutalist and Nickel Boys and Hard Truths, and you know, which I didn't choose because they were downers, but I just chose, was like, oh, but I'm looking at it, it's like, oh, should I put in a comedy? I don't know. I mean, you know, and you know, Hard Truths is actually very, very funny, and it's the idea, I know I said in that piece or that interview, whatever, that, you know, no great movie is truly depressing, but yeah, I wonder if I am that way, and sometimes I wish that I did have a lighter temperament of kinds. You know, I wish that I did recommend comedies more, and I think, like, yeah, I wonder if I have some kind of something in my temperament. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I'm a drag to be around. People tell me but sometimes, you know, we all have our moments. But I don't know if there is something in cinema that really does, you know, there is something that kind of speaks to that. I think that you go in, you know, I love laughing at the movies. I love, you know, that can really lift your spirits. But I don't know, you kind of, yeah, you can, you know, you can kind of retreat into something, and you get in touch with, you know, I don't know, you just have this kind of very personal, intimate experience with the movie, and inevitably that touches on something melancholy and something sad. And I don't know what it was with that this past year, with those three films, which weren't not necessarily like my absolute favorites this year, but they were the ones that were kind of opening at that time. And I don't know what it is, just but they're all great, you know, so.
There's definitely something like a lot more technical about them, like even going like touching on the idea of like editing or a perspective of film, right. They're definitely like way better paced and like way more interesting to pull apart, and I think that's really cool. Does that kind of influence your like perception of film, like the technique that you can see or what you can take out of it, or like how you approach writing about it then?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's interesting because the movie I liked a lot of films last year, but the movie I picked as my number one, which is Victor Erice's Close Your Eyes, which is a Spanish film, which is very, really quite simple in its construction. It's a long film, but it's not doing lots of flashy formal things, you know, and there was, I had a weird experience with that movie where it's one of those weird things where halfway through, I wasn't even sure if I liked it. Like, that doesn't happen often, actually. Usually you kind of get a sense, and it's like, I wasn't even sure. I was tired. It was in Cannes. I was tired. It was like, oh, it's not working for me. Maybe I should just walk out and get some sleep, you know? And it kind of helped me, and I stuck with it. And the most kind of amazing thing happened where just a complete 180. I was like, there was a scene in the middle, and if you've seen the movie, you kind of know what it is. And from that moment on, you're like, okay, I am completely in this movie's grip, and I need to stay. And not only that, it retroactively turns like everything else before that into like the greatest thing ever. And then I went back and saw it again. I was like, what was I thinking? This movie's great. And so, in some ways, that was why it was my favorite. Sometimes it was the most persuasive film, and it kind of had the most work to do to kind of pull me back. And then I really fell in love with it. But in terms of technique or form, it's, you know, it's a well-made film, but it's not necessarily doing the most complex or rigorous things on that level. But in general, I am drawn to things that demonstrate some formal interest and ambition. I try not to, because I do fundamentally believe that, you know, that's important, and that's, you know, with art, that's a real standard or measure by which some greatness can be measured. But at the same time, I don't want to just look at movies just through that prism. Like, for example, I don't know, this, you know, like, I really liked Radu Juda's movie, Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, Romanian comedy, which is an insane movie that is just doing so much, and it's very, you know, it's very kind of consciously Godardian in some ways, in terms of, like, what it's, you know, it's got, like, half of another film that's, like, spliced into the narrative. It's doing, you know, it's switching color and format, and it's, like, it's got TikTok. It's formally, it's just an insane film. And so I responded to that, absolutely. And it's also just really fun to write about. And I do come back to the writing, where, like, I think it's fun to write about stuff that is just formally kind of extreme, you know? I think that that's, like, and it gets you away from, oh, just writing again about plot and characters and dialogue. That's important, you know, but it's, like, when you can actually, writing about, and maybe this is something with editing as well, it was really fun to write that, but I like writing about cinematography. And again, I'm not trained in these things, and my powers of description are limited, really, to just kind of what I can see. I'm not an expert on, you know, whatever, aspect ratios, techniques, you know, anything of that. But I just like, and this is something I tell my students, just, you know, just write about what you see. And, you know, look, you really have to look and closely, and you might have to replay. And I've done that, where I will actually see how, like, a sequence is put together to really kind of nail the essence of what's going on. But yeah, I am kind of drawn toward that. And with these films, yeah, I mean, obviously with, like, Nickel Boys, which I think is just the greatest and most underrated American movie that I saw last year, and that movie is so slept on, and I am prepared for people to finally, like, you know, about 6 months or a year from now, saying, oh, Nickel Boys, you know, that was really great. It's like, yeah, you know, so it's like, we tried to tell you, you know, like, you know, way after the Oscars are over and forgotten. No, I'm just kidding. There are some good movies, including The Brutalist and Anora and all those that are up for Oscars. And so, but I think that, yeah, that movie is obviously a big formal technical swing. The Brutalist is as well. So, yes, I am, I think, there's something about that that really does speak to me. However, I always try to, you know, it's not just about that either, you know. And I sometimes like to surprise myself with what my favorites are. I sometimes feel like I shouldn't. Well, you try not to, like, second-guess yourself too much, or you think about it even all that hard. You try to be instinctive. But I sometimes like when I'm kind of like, oh, I didn't expect to put that there. It must be the right one, because it's kind of, you know, when we're talking about list making, which, you know, is a fun thing to do. So
I'm going to address the elephant in the room, sure, let's say. Yeah. You are a Pulitzer winner. I was just curious, just in general, because you've been in the industry for a long time. And does the, like, first of all, nomination, let's say, for a Pulitzer, does that come from a third party? Right. Is it yourself that you submit this? Mm-hmm. Also, unlike, like, the fiction and the nonfiction, it is several pieces, several materials that are submitted. I read the one for Oppenheimer, which I think is the main one that's been awarded, which I also think was brilliant. But just how does the whole process come through? Yes. And a bit more.
This is an elephant in the room that I love talking about. It's like it's the greatest elephant ever. It's like, you know, this was, that whole experience was just amazing. And it was basically, it's not the same for everyone, but in my case, you know, individual writers can submit their own work. I've always been grateful that the LA Times and even Variety too, when I was there for about a year or two, I think, submitted me a couple times. So I think, and I would sometimes tell the LA Times if I didn't think I had a great year or had an off year, I'd be like, you know, guys, you don't have to know, you know, it's, they have to limit the number of, you know, and it's one criticism section, so they have multiple, you know, and they have so many critics at the LA Times, so it's like not like film, they should submit their film critic or their TV critic or whoever every year, but they were very generous in consistently putting my work forward. I think like most of the 8 years I was there, I think I was submitted, and with nothing to show for it, and you know, because it's insane, it's such, having, you know, one now, it's like I can tell you, I feel just more fortunate than anything, because it is such a crapshoot. There are so many great critics that you're going up against. It's like, I just feel like the timing worked out. I was proud of the work, especially that Oppenheimer piece. It was definitely, I think, the best portfolio I submitted, and so that was really nice. Really, really nice. Like, life-changingly, mind-blowingly nice. But not at all expected. I was completely shocked when I found out and, you know, screamed myself hoarse for about, you know, a week. I think, though, that yes, it was. It can be a portfolio of work, as mine was. I think there were 7 pieces, which I think is the limit now. I think in past years you could submit as many as 10. My editors submitted me, but I knew they told me they were submitting me, and I knew that the Oppenheimer piece would be part of that. I knew that the Everything Everywhere All at Once piece that I wrote, those were kind of the two big ones that sort of anchored that portfolio. The other 5 pieces, I had no idea what they were putting forward, and I'd be like, and it's really weird because I look back and I'm like, I wouldn't have submitted that one. But then I'm thinking, how can I complain? This is what won. So it's like, how could I presume to know better than what they did? So they're like, I am fine with them. That's a good job, guys. And so, but yeah, it doesn't have to be just, it can be just one piece. I mean, one of the finalists, Zadie Smith, you know, her really great Tar review, that was the only piece that submitted. It was great enough to get her into the, finalist citation. So it's, it's very much up to editors and, you know, those decisions, and you can submit yourself if you're not being submitted by your publication, and you, I've never had to do that, which is really nice again, so, but, yeah.
So I was just going to ask, like, I know you have extensively written on Oppenheimer in particular, and I wanted to ask you specifically about, like, runtimes of films and how you've, like, quality in terms of like quantity of time in films, and does it like work better or worse, and kind of how, you know, like, because I've found that like there are a few short films that are wonderful, wonderful films, and then I've found that in my own experience there are a few features that are maybe just a little bit too long, and how, like, you know, what your opinion on that is.
I mean, people really, running time is interesting to talk about, right? People often think about it. It's the first thing they think about. It's not for me, but I understand why. I mean, I don't. It's funny because there is sort of I'm someone, I think, who has maybe more patience than some. So more patience for longer running times, and so. I have an old friend/colleague who used to say it's like, it isn't cinema until it's 3 hours, you know, which is, you know, he's kind of self-mockingly, of course, that's not true, but it's like there's that idea of like committing, like you're in it for this really grand, enveloping kind of experience it's interesting to think about something like The Brutalist, which is quite long, but which I think, you know, in the movie is obviously not everyone loves it, but the thing that, for those who like it, realizes, wow, this movie doesn't feel 3.5 hours. It really is very well paced to the point where you actually want more of it. I mean, if anything, there are things, it feels almost incomplete, weirdly, which is kind of a remarkable thing to say about a 3.5 hour movie. And then when Killers of the Flower Moon came out, and I don't love that movie, I have a lot of issues with it, but it annoyed me, kind of on Martin Scorsese's behalf, that that just became the running joke about the movie. It's like, oh my god, it's so long. And it's like, it's not that long. You know, it's like, it's, you know, it's worth your time, and it actually should be longer. It's like, I think it would be a better movie if it were longer. And this, of course, gets into things about, like, well, it's funny how, like, you know, a 2.5 hour or 3.5 hour feature is too much for some, but, you know, a 10 hour Netflix series, of course, it's like, oh, sign me up. It's like, there's no, and I know it's different. It's like, it's a commitment of time. It's like going to a cinema. So there's those factors and everything. But I do fear that in some ways people are, you know, just running times, attention spans, checking your phone, all of those things, impatience, unwillingness to surrender to a movie. And God, I have it too. You know, it's harder. You know, sometimes, you know, discreetly, I don't take my phone out. Never do that. But sometimes checking the time on your watch or whatever, and it's like, so yeah, we all have to kind of sometimes guard against, you know, that kind of impatience sometimes, but at the same time, I don't really, you know, I don't fetishize long running times either. I just think, you know, is this did the filmmaker use this time well? I think sometimes too, when you go to festivals, especially like Cannes, where sometimes it varies from year to year, but I remember there are some years where it's like every movie is like north of 2.5 hours, and it's like, it's a lot. And to kind of your question about earlier about like just processing, it's like, it's a lot to process, and it's like, you think like these are, like any one of these movies is too much to digest in one sitting, and we're having to like, you know, go to like three of them a day. It's too much. And so it's, festivals can sometimes in that way be both the best and the worst places to see movies. But the thing about this is that one good thing that comes from, I think, seeking out a lot of different types of movies is it really changes your own rhythms, your internal rhythms. And it's weird how everyone's rhythm is different. Mine probably pulses slower than some others, and so I can kind of relax into something. It's really kind of nice and actually feels shorter than something that is like, you know, really jitter. But in my writing, I try to sometimes tell readers to sort of, you know, allow yourself to kind of submit to this, and it's worth it. And it might seem off-putting or challenging, but it's worth the challenge, you know. And so, you know, I think sometimes I do get impatient with critics who sort of like say like, oh, this taut 95-minute thriller, why can't they make them like this anymore? And it's like, yeah, okay, that's great, but you know, that's not, it's like the other thing, just to bring it back to editing too, is like, so many people think that a well-edited film is a short film, and that is just such bullshit. Sorry, it's like, I'm not gonna say that. It's a really, having written a book on editing, I do feel qualified to say like it has nothing to do with running time. It's like, it really doesn't. So editing is one of the most misunderstood things. And people who sometimes, you know, who joke about like, like, why is a 3-hour movie up for best editing? And it's like, you have no idea what you're talking about.
You mentioned The Brutalist a lot on the Oscars, and I wanted to ask your opinion as a film critic, what your thoughts were in The Substance and Nosferatu being nominated for Oscars as horror films. It's the first time in, I think, 28 years since Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I'm trying to think if there have been other exceptions since then. Certainly, I mean, The Silence of the Lambs is a real, I mean, that's, there have been dark movies, like, say, No Country for Old Men that have won since, but as far as being, truly a horror film, I think that it's kind of, it hasn't really happened since, has it? Get Out was nominated. That's very true. That's a very, very good point. Yes, it's a great yes. And good. That's absolutely the case. And there have been other. I'm just forgetting. There have been many films nominated, but The Substance, you know, which I don't think is going to win Best Picture, but it's pretty remarkable. You know, that, you know, Demi Moore obviously having come a long way. And I think that, and Nosferatu too, which even though that mostly got, I think, technical nominations, I do wonder if it had come out earlier, if it would have had, you know, maybe a better chance. But yeah, no, it's hard to say. And I quite like The Substance. It's not my, I'm actually a movie that is really polarized opinion. People push to kind of love it or hate it extremes. I'm kind of right in the middle, weirdly. I like the film. I don't think it's the greatest thing ever, but I also don't think it's a crime against cinema the way some folks do. So with that in mind, in a very neutral way, I think it's great that horror is being taken more seriously. And I mean, we can talk about, I'm not really someone who follows or participates in the debates about like elevated horror and what that is. I mean, it's a term I really try to avoid. That said, though, you know, I think it is interesting that The Substance and Nosferatu, something they have in common is that they are horror movies that do feel like prestige cinema, right? And that's and that can, whether that's a good or bad thing is, you know, not for me to say, but their movie, and it will be interesting to see how The Substance plays out in terms of what it ends up winning, if it does. I mean, Coralie Farja obviously getting a director nomination, having to overcome a lot of hurdles, more than just her gender and her nationality. I mean, have two French directors in this year's race with her and Jacques Audiard, which is obviously goes to show just how much more international the Academy is becoming, which I think is a wonderful thing, instead of just... Justine Trier, exactly right. And so it's like every year there's a French director or two, you know, so like, and I think it's great. I mean, it's like there used to always be an international... one filmmaker who was an American at least, and now it's like you can count on more than just one. I think it's a good thing. You know, I really, one of the things I've written about over the years is just how Americentric the Oscars are, and I understand, you know, it's Hollywood and everything, but their membership is now all over the world, and that's great because there's so many more movies to consider, and why, you know, the U.S. doesn't have monopoly on any kind of greatness, especially now. So beyond movies, even obviously. So with The Substance, yeah, having to overcome sort of the perhaps anti-genre bias as well, in addition to being a French woman. So, and I don't know though, because you might see it could be a mirage. Maybe it's well liked enough to be nominated, but I am sure there are people who pop in their screeners of The Substance and turn it off after half an hour. You know that you've heard about those things. It's a divisive film to begin with, so I don't know, but it does say something about the fact that it's gotten this far. And it's interesting. I have to say too, when I saw The Substance in Cannes, which was one of the most fun press screenings. Were you there by chance? No, my God, that was, oh my God, it was. You know, and again, I have issues with the movie, but it was one of the most fun. We were just, the entire audience was just, you know, we were just on the floor by the end. That final half hour is really something to see with a packed house, and you know, a packed house of pretty jaded journalists who've mostly seen just about everything you can see, and it's like, oh, there's still room to be surprised by something. And so, and I, it's really funny because I didn't put The Substance on my list, but I have to say, in terms of memorable experiences, it was kind of that one. And I, you know, in a way, to be really honest, it's like I would have probably included that. But anyway, it's just I don't know where I was going with that. I've trailed off, but it was, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So you've mentioned the idea of films and art, and then you talked about like teaching a bunch of young students, and we are also young film critics. Where do you want to see film criticism go in the future, and like the appreciation of film? Because you've done like podcasts where you've talked with like the Review Hour. Like, is there going to be a space for that form of film criticism? Do you think it could go in that direction? Do you think that our perception and like our appreciation is going to change? What do you want to see from this generation?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, I have to. It's what I want from this generation.
I'm sorry, that was very loaded.
No. It's always, the future questions are always the hardest ones, and the ones I feel least qualified to. And it's really, and it's because it's on, you know, you all, of course. You know, you all are gonna forge ahead and make that future whatever it will be. I always have to say that I'm really, honestly, just impressed by how I see folks who are going at it, who are going to festivals, and who are really working their, you know, working their butts off in a way, in kind of like the way I did when I was younger. But and I did it with, I went for my, you know, I again was employed full time. It was my job. I had a, you know, so it was easier. I think there are people who are working, you know, full time or part time and doing this on the side, and it's like, and that's a real commitment, you know, and it can't be taken for granted. So I just think having that stamina and that passion, I mean, they're clearly driven by passion. It's nothing else, you know, they really love to. And that, but, you know, it's like, I want, you know, that to be more sustainable, because some people are just barely scraping by. Most people are, I'd say, are barely scraping by doing that. And for me, too, it's like, it was always, you know, film criticism has never, there have never been a lot of, full-time, well-paying jobs. I can't tell you how fortunate I feel to have been able to do this for a living, and to be, to have the creative freedom I've had, and also just the financial freedom to do it. It's like, I don't take that for granted for a second. So I would just like to see, just, you know, and I know this is, it's like, it's not just film criticism, just a crisis in journalism, especially in the U.S., but everywhere too. Arts coverage often being the first thing to go, so it's like, it really is even more, just ever more a freelancer's game. And but I don't know, I really do think that it's, and it's interesting too, because film criticism is becoming more diverse, and that's a wonderful thing. But it's, I think this is just the thing, of course, as that diversity starts to kick in finally, it's like, oh yeah, that's when the business models just completely melt down. It's like, that's, and those things aren't, you know, that's, it's really a terrible thing. And so I feel like, in a way, film criticism is becoming more, you know, democratic than ever. I keep learning things. I learn about, you know, there's so much cinema I haven't seen, and so many, you know, whatever it's genres, or just whole entire national cinemas that I'm really woefully, you know, under aware of. And so I really feel like there's just so much more work to do, and not just new movies, but older movies too. I mean, that's, and increasingly film criticism, I think, is about older films as well. And so I just, I don't know, it's like, I feel like it's actually in good hands. It's just, can those hands, you know, be sustained, and can they make a living at this? You know, that's really, I don't think there's a dearth of talent, or even media literacy. You know, I think that, I mean, there's, of course there's problems with that, but I think that the folks who are doing this are exceptionally literate and smart. So, yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to be hopeful about a lot of things right now. But it ultimately comes back to, for me, it's like, you know, I just spent like a few days in Berlin. I didn't see that much, but I saw some really good movies. And I've often thought that there is this symbiotic relationship between criticism and cinema. And so if there's still good movies, if there's hope for the movies, there's hope for movie criticism, right? You know, I really do believe in that, that there's a link there. And that's more than, I think, what keeps me going. I'm going to cry, I think, in a second, as I think about this. It's like, when you ask me about, like, where, how do you keep going, it's like, well, the movies do keep me going, you know, more so than the sound of my own voice. It's like, oh, and this is why criticism feeds, if it becomes an art in itself, it feeds off other arts. And so it's like, and so if that is there, then I feel filled up and I can still, you know, do the work. So there's something to work on. It's not just me. It's the filmmakers. It's the artists. So, yeah.
That was fascinating. Thank you.
Sure.
I think we're about almost done.
Yeah.
So
okay,
just
sure.
As like a last
sure.
finishing question, what's like one, like, really important piece of advice that you would give to, you know, critics like us, or people starting and getting into the criticism sphere?
Mm-hmm. This is very simple, very obvious, very unoriginal, but just read as much as you can. Watch as much as you can and read as much as you can. If there's one thing I think I don't do enough for my students, is give them more enough reading, because I was self-taught. And I think that's the way to do it. And so, and it's not just reading other critics too. I mean, it's reading everything, you know, and reading books as well. But it's like, but I really do think that, I think a pitfall of young critics is sometimes feeling like that it is all about their voice and all about their background and their personality, whatever. Those things are important, absolutely. But those things will come out naturally. And it's like, keep your focus, this kind of ties into the last question, keep your focus on the work. You know, it's about the work. It isn't about you. It's already about you. You know, you writing something, it's already about you. You don't need to, like, overemphasize that. I think, like, keep your attention on the work and your relationship with that. And if you have something there, it's like, it'll come through. And that's I think, where the most meaningful work comes from. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank this you. Has been The Young Critics and Justin Chang. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute joy talking to you all.